The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You know, it may have just been a change in calculus where the value of what they were collecting had decreased and the value of disruption now outweighed that. Or it's an indication that the government values disruption more today than they did in the past. And I think there's probably some elements of both, because we've seen the U.S. government in a number of contexts take more aggressive action to disrupt the activities of, you know, the FSB and other state actors, and also ransomware groups.
I'm Stephanie Pell, senior editor at Lawfare, and this is the Lawfare podcast, May 19th, 2023. Over the past 2 weeks, the Department of Justice has issued two press releases announcing disruption efforts it has taken against malicious cyber actors. One operation involved the disruption of Russia's so-called snake malware network, and the other involved the indictment of a Russian national for ransomware attacks on critical infrastructure. To talk about these disruption efforts, I sat down with Alex Iftimi, partner at the law firm Morrison Forrester, and a former federal prosecutor in the National Security and Cyber Crimes Units in the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of Virginia. We talked about the operational details and sophistication of some aspects of these disruption operations, the significance and relationship of these operations to other disruption efforts, and how these recent efforts fit into the broader picture of the DOJ's and the U.S. government's efforts to disrupt malicious cyber actors. It's the Lawfare podcast, May 19th. Alex Iftimi on DOJ's recent cyber disruption efforts. On Tuesday, May 9th, the Department of Justice issued a press release announcing a court-authorized disruption of the snake malware network, which it says was controlled by Russia's Federal Security Service. There's a lot to unpack just in the title of the press release. Alex, can you talk about what happened in this disruption operation and what a court-authorized disruption means?
Stephanie, thank you. Glad to do that. Let me touch briefly on what the disruption operation was. The FBI and international partners have been tracking the Russian FSB's snake malware for nearly two decades, and in recent years appeared to have developed the means to track and to closely monitor the spread of this malware. Last week on May 9th, the Department of Justice announced the completion of what it called Operation Medusa, which was a multinational operation, as these operations almost always are these days, which took proactive steps to disable this so-called snake malware. Snake malware is essentially, it's a backdoor that the FSB had used to facilitate intelligence collection, and that allowed them to control computers, to monitor the activity on those computers, and to steal information. The FBI believes this tool was used for the FSB's intelligence collection. The operation itself essentially involved sending commands to permanently disable the malware, by overriding key components of the malware and essentially causing the malware to shut itself off.
And that was done without affecting any legitimate applications on the target computers.
That's exactly right. And what's notable about this operation is it went into the, or it sent commands to the systems of a victim. So this wasn't an operation directed at command and control infrastructure used by the operators of this malware. They essentially went out into, in this case, 8 computers in the United States that were the computers of victim organizations and issued commands that would cause the malware to shut itself down. And exactly as you say, the way in which the operation was structured was very carefully structured so that other information on those systems, which were the systems of unwitting victims, was not affected.
And the FBI sought and got authorization to do this from a court, which makes the court-authorized aspect of this that's in the title of DOJ's press release, that's what it means. They got authorization to carry out this operation from a court.
That's right. They essentially got a search warrant, and that meant presenting a search warrant application to a court. That application has to be based on a probable cause affidavit by a law enforcement officer, and the judge had to approve the warrant. And that warrant, of course, lays out the scope of the operation and what the government is authorized to do. So written into that search warrant were the limits that you just described, essentially, to make sure that the operation didn't affect other aspects of those systems. And anytime you're dealing with an operation that requires access to computer systems in the United States, that's likely to be a considered a search, and the government needs judicial authorization to do that. And so that, of course, is different than the way these operations might be carried out by the U.S. government outside of the United States.
So it appears from the search warrant affidavit that the U.S. government has been investigating Snake and the Snake-related malware tools for nearly 20 years. Can you talk about what the Snake malware network was?
Sure. And let me say what is perhaps most interesting about the operation and the court documents accompanying it is just the level of detail we got about the U.S.'s investigation of and monitoring over many years of the FSB's use of this Snake malware. And in some ways, these court documents seem to, in part, just be designed to highlight the level of understanding over the better part of a decade that the FBI has had of this particular malware, and in essence, to kind of poke the FSB in the eye. It's an interesting lens into the spy games between the United States and Russia. But as you say, the FBI and the U.S. government more broadly had been tracking this Snake malware for the better part of 20 years. And of course, I imagine this malware has changed quite a bit over those 20 years because, of course, our digital lives have changed quite a bit over the last 20 years. And what was true in the early 2020s or early 2000s, I should say, is very different than how computers operate today. What we know is that the Snake malware was operated by a unit within the FSB known as Center 16. Center 16 is primarily responsible for FSB signals intelligence, and it's the signals intelligence arm of the FSB that in turn sits alongside other intelligence agencies in Russia, like the SVR and the GRU. The unit in particular, the Center 16, it's been known by a variety of code names, depending on the security company you're talking to. It's been known as Venomous Bear. It's been known as Waterbug. The FBI itself has referred to this FSB unit as Turla.
And was there also a joint cyber advisory that came out with the unsealing of this search warrant affidavit and the press release that gave us some insight about snake malware and the snake malware network and talked about its level of sophistication.
Yes, that's exactly right. So the U.S. government, alongside agencies from other Five Eye partners, essentially put out an incredibly detailed technical report of how this malware operates. And it describes the snake implant in great technical detail, essentially how it communicates, how the peer-to-peer network works, what the obfuscation and encryption mechanisms were within this malware. And that, of course, is very useful for security companies to be able to understand the malware, to spot it in other places, to be able to look for similar malware that's out there. And this joint cyber advisory described this snake implant as one of the most sophisticated, if not the most sophisticated, cyber espionage tool that the FSB had and had used for long-term intelligence collection for sensitive targets.
Do we know how the U.S. government attributed the snake malware at issue to the FSB?
We have some sense of it from the search warrant affidavit. The affidavit goes through some detail of what operations had taken place over the last few years related to these Russian intelligence efforts. And it seems like the FBI has been monitoring this malware for some time. For example, the affidavit notes that between 2015 and 2017, so we're talking, you know, as many as 8 years ago, the FBI was monitoring this malware on victim computers in the United States, that they were aware that these computers were communicating with other victim computers, including a foreign ministry of foreign affairs. The affidavit indicates that the FBI at the time was able to decrypt the communications between these different instances of the snake malware, and that they were able to see the information that these actors were trying to exfiltrate from victim environments. They were able to see that some of the targets were endpoints associated with NATO. And they also note in a very interesting turn of phrase that they were able to see that the snake operators tried to exfiltrate a large amount of data that they believed to be NATO and UN documents. And that to me sure sounds like a false flag operation or some type of operation where law enforcement was, along with international partners, were aware of what these hackers were trying to go after and may have substituted or created information for them to take that wasn't actually NATO or UN information. And the affidavit really goes into quite a bit of painstaking detail of these various operations over the years. And I think it's pretty clear that over the course of that, they also learned a lot of information about the actors behind this activity. The government knew, for example, that this malware was operated by individuals at a specific FSB facility in Ryazan, Russia. We know that they understood the working hours of these operators between approximately 7 a.m. and 8 p.m. Moscow time. And they were also able to attribute this malware because the developers of this malware had left in portions of code or monikers or other taunts of security researchers that essentially allowed the FBI, when they saw this malware, to attribute it to particular individuals that they may have identified via other means. And so it seems like over the years, the FBI has developed a pretty good understanding of exactly who was behind the keyboard in operating this malware. And at one point in the affidavit, they even note that some of the FSB officers who were using this malware appeared to know how to use it better than others. And so they had quite a granular understanding of who was using the tool when.
So how did this network operate and what kinds of things did it do?
So it, as I mentioned, it's a backdoor, right? The purpose of this is to create surreptitious access to a victim environment, to be able to access those computers, to see what they're being used for, to take information from them. It was a digital tool for espionage. What is interesting about this tool is it created a peer-to-peer network. And that essentially means that the different instances of this malware would talk to one another. So it wasn't just a structure where the malware beacons out to its home base, its command and control infrastructure, but in fact, the different instances of the malware would talk to one another. And that is important because it's a mechanism for obfuscation. The commands and the theft of information essentially could be coming from another computer in a trusted network. And so it's harder to identify what is malicious activity. It clearly was a very sophisticated piece of malware. It had mechanisms to maintain persistence. So even if you tried to get rid of it from an environment, it would find ways to stay there. It was well disguised. The traffic that was coming through looked like legitimate traffic. And so a security team that would see this traffic wouldn't necessarily know that it's something that was malicious.
And do we have a sense of the importance of snake malware in the FSB's espionage efforts?
You know, it's hard to tell. The first point is, it really seemed like this was a tool that wasn't used that frequently. Only a few systems were infected in the United States. The FBI was aware of eight of those systems. There were more systems internationally. And one of the things we know is that the United States and allied governments had been monitoring this tool for many years. And I expect as a result of that, those prior investigations, that the US and other governments had taken steps to make sure that the Russian government wasn't able to obtain valuable intelligence with the tool. So I fully expect that the usefulness of this tool had been degraded as a result of prior government investigations, but this was clearly a sophisticated tool. It was one that the FSB was still using, and so certainly it's something that would have had some importance to those espionage efforts.
And the false flag operation that you previously mentioned is illustrative of, again, the U.S. government having insight to what was going on and essentially perhaps conducting their own intelligence operation to gain further information about this network and this malware and more generally how Russia conducts espionage activities. Is that too much to conclude?
I don't think that's too much to conclude at all. I would add to it that it would have given the U.S. government a lot of insight into what information Russia was after, what type of information it was seeking out and considered valuable. It also would have provided a source of intelligence in understanding who the actors are behind this activity, as we talked about just a bit ago.
So from the details provided in the press release and the search warrant affidavit that was unsealed, what was DOJ actually authorized to do? And what kinds of actions does it appear that DOJ took pursuant to the search warrant?
So I think we've talked a bit about this at the outset. The search warrant essentially authorized the government to issue commands to these victim computers or the malware sitting on these victim computers. These commands were commands that would only be understood by the malware and wouldn't have any other impact on other portions of these systems. And these commands caused the malware to essentially disable itself by wiping key portions of the malware code. The operation was directed just at these systems that were known to have this particular malware on them. And the warrant was written in a way to ensure that DOJ wasn't authorized to search the whole computer to seize other portions of information beyond the very specific piece of malware sitting on the computer.
In the search warrant context, your use of the term seize is interesting here. Rule 41, as we know, certainly gives the DOJ, when it meets the appropriate probable cause standard, the opportunity to seize evidence. How is seized being interpreted, used, and applied here?
Well, I think of it in the following way. And so, and I think it's an important distinction, right? When you typically think of a warrant, you're thinking of something that allows, particularly in the electronic context, you think of something that allows the government to obtain copies of records, right? Like a copy of your email inbox or something like that. Here, what we're talking about is taking a step that permanently disables an application or in this case a piece of malware that is sitting on someone's computer. And so certainly this is malware that was unwanted by these victims, although one could argue that's not for the government to decide, right? And so part of the authority that is granted as part of a warrant is also a seizure authority, which is for the government to essentially take something. And so you could think of this analogizing it to if law enforcement breaks into a warehouse and seizes drug paraphernalia or drugs from a location, or if they go into a bank vault and take a safety deposit box. Those are seizures, and the government is authorized to do those pursuant to a search warrant if they can show that whatever they're seizing is evidence of a crime, is an instrumentality of a crime. And certainly this kind of malware is exactly that. It's an instrumentality that the snake operators were using to commit crimes in the United States.
So you've talked a bit about the sophistication of the snake malware network and the malware itself. But it also seems from the search warrant affidavit that the DOJ's technical disruption operation was very sophisticated. Can you talk a bit about that?
I can. I think what is interesting about it is the FBI had reverse engineered this malware. They understood very clearly how it worked, what its signatures were, so they could identify it in other networks. And it understood the communications between these pieces of malware and the authentication protocols, you know, how it knew that certain commands were coming from its handlers in great detail. And what the FBI was able to do was to impersonate essentially commands that would be coming from the FSB handlers of this malware. And they issued commands to this malware that essentially looked like the commands that would be coming from the FSB, and that caused the malware to essentially take steps to self-destruct.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
You see in the search warrant affidavit a number of Greek mythology puns, snake malware, Operation Medusa. Alex, given your time as an assistant United States attorney, are these kinds of things common, or, you know, what do we make of these analogies or use of Greek mythology puns?
I make of them the fact that some agents who have spent a great many years looking at this malware were having some fun. It definitely seems like those who are investigating this particular malware, like their Greek mythology puns. And I will only add to your list the fact that the tools and commands that the FBI and partner governments used to disable this malware, they were called Perseus, and Perseus is, of course, the demigod who beheaded Medusa. So there's no shortage of puns to go through over the years.
So the search warrant affidavit indicated that it was important for the FBI to take coordinated action to disable the snake implants. What does such coordinated action mean from an operational perspective, and why was it important for the FBI to proceed in this way?
Well, anytime you have one of these disruption operations, you want to make sure that you don't let the operators of the malware or the botnet, in some cases, be able to reconstitute their operations by taking defensive action. And so it's important to time these disruption operations to not give the bad guys time to find ways to undo them or to prevent them once they see them in one or two cases to take other steps to protect the rest of the malware. And we've seen these kinds of coordinated operations time and time again between the United States and allied governments, and they really do involve close coordination between law enforcement and intelligence agencies to pick a particular time when these commands are issued contemporaneously. Part of the challenge in conducting this kind of operation is the FBI can't just go around and do what it did in the United States in all countries, because they don't have authorization to do that. It may ruffle feathers of other jurisdictions. And so you have law enforcement or intelligence organizations essentially in each of the countries that had victim computers taking coordinated action at the same time to disrupt this malware and not give the FSB an opportunity to reconstitute the malware on those systems.
And the warrant actually requested a delay of service of up to 30 days after it was executed. Why was that necessary? Is that part of the coordinated action?
Yes, that's exactly right. It's in part of the coordinated action. It's in part of the FBI didn't want providing notice of this operation to individuals to potentially get out before they conducted the operation that would give the FSB or other parts of the Russian government an opportunity to take defensive action. And the procedures that exist for issuing a search warrant allow for that kind of delay in notice in very specific cases. And one of the cases where they allow that is in a situation where there's a reason to believe that premature notice of the execution of the warrant might allow for the destruction of evidence or that would allow the criminals to flee or things like that. And so that's what they used in this case to delay notice. Although I will say they said in their affidavit that they intended to provide notice as quickly as they could after taking the action, that they didn't expect they would need the entire 30 days.
And how would you compare this disruption operation to other disruption operations we've seen the DOJ publicize over the past 18 months or 2 years?
In some ways, it's quite similar to operations we have seen recently. The one that I analogize this to is a similar operation to go into the victim systems to disrupt malware that had been left behind by the Hafnium actors. Hafnium is a group that was attributed to the Chinese state-sponsored activity that that exploited a vulnerability in Microsoft Exchange. When that vulnerability was about to be patched, the hackers essentially went into as many computers that were vulnerable to to this exploit and left behind malware so that after the patch was implemented, they could still get into those systems. And the U.S. government, in that case, the Department of Justice, again, using a search warrant authority, just like we have here, went into the systems of victims to issue commands to that very specific malware that was deployed by the Hafnium actors and to, again, disable that malware. We've seen similar operations over really the better part of a decade to disrupt botnets using criminal authorities. What I would say is these operations get more sophisticated each time the government undertakes them. And so it's clear that they're learning and becoming more ambitious in the operations that they undertake, but they're also following a very set kind of framework for how to conduct these types of operations.
So you've touched upon this, but do you consider this disruption of the snake malware to be a progression of USG efforts to disrupt espionage or other malicious cyber operations? Is this, and I appreciate we don't know everything the US government does in this arena, but would you categorize this as a real level above with respects to the sophistication that was required to disrupt this snake malware network?
Well, I think what I would say about it is the legal framework that they used to accomplish this is one they've used previously. I didn't really see anything in there that surprised me or that looked different from what the government has done before. I think what's a really interesting aspect of this operation is it's an example of the government disrupting a piece of malware that really for at least 8 years, if not longer, since they've been tracking this for 20 years, they've had very good visibility into what the FSB has been doing with this malware. And that has clearly been a source of intelligence for the US government. And for them to take disruptive action, it really means burning a source that they've had for a number of years. And so what I think it speaks to is the, you know, constant tension the government faces between essentially its collection efforts, its goals to collect information, and its goals to disrupt this activity and to prevent it from happening in the future. And we're seeing the U.S. government in this context lean into the disruption in taking action to finally kind of end this piece of malware. And you know, it may have just been a changing calculus where the value of what they were collecting had decreased and the value of disruption now outweighed that. Or it's an indication that the government values disruption more today than they did in the past. And I think there's probably some elements of both, because we've seen the U.S. government in a number of contexts take more aggressive action to disrupt the activities of, you know, the FSB and other state actors, and also ransomware groups and criminal actors who are doing harm to the United States.
So might there have been a number of interagency discussions to determine when it was time to disrupt?
I expect there would have been that kind of coordination, and I expect that conversation would have occurred not just among U.S. government agencies, but also with international partners who also clearly had equities in this operation, because many of the victim systems would have been in their jurisdictions, not in the United States.
So what I'd like to do is talk to you about a second disruption operation that occurred on May 16th. DOJ issued a press release indicating that a Russian national was charged with committing ransomware attacks against critical infrastructure, and it unsealed two indictments, one from the District of New Jersey and one from the District of Columbia. So what is the defendant, Mikhail Pavlovich Mateyev, alleged to have done?
So DOJ alleges that Matveev used three different ransomware variants over the course of several years to attack law enforcement agencies like police departments in Passaic County, New Jersey, and the Metropolitan Police in Washington, D.C. They targeted a healthcare organization in New Jersey and other infrastructure, I should say critical infrastructure targets. And in this particular case, Matveev was associated with the Lockbit ransomware, Babook ransomware, and Hive ransomware as well.
So this indictment tells us something about how ransomware actors such as the defendant are using multiple malware variants. Have we seen these variants surface in other disruption efforts before?
Yes, we definitely have. So the Hive ransomware group is one that Department of Justice shut down just earlier this year in January, after having had access to the systems of that ransomware group for a number of months. And in fact, they had been surreptitiously getting decryption keys from the systems of the Hive group and passing them to victims in the United States. And we covered this operation on a prior podcast. The Hive connection is actually really notable here, because the Attorney General in announcing the Hive disruption previewed in his remarks that our investigation into the criminal conduct of Hive members remains ongoing. And that was a pretty clear indication that the Department of Justice was not just interested in the operational infrastructure of the Hive ransomware group, but also the individual members who were responsible for the activity. And here we're seeing one of those individuals who has now been charged in two districts. I'll say one other thing that is really notable about this indictment is that it lays out what we have known for quite some time about these ransomware groups, which is that the ransomware ecosystem is fluid, and that the same individuals move around between ransomware groups. And as one group shuts down, the hackers move to the next group and or set up a new name to operate under. And here we've got this individual, Matveev, who had been associated with a number of ransomware groups over the years. So it lays out in the indictment how some of these operators really move around to continue to conduct these criminal schemes.
Some have described some of these efforts as, while good, that it is at times essentially playing a game of whack-a-mole. Is that a fair description or critique?
Well, it is no doubt a game of whack-a-mole, but there's value in staying at it, because each time the government conducts a disruption operation, it increases the costs to those actors. It means they have to rebuild, it means they have to set up new infrastructure. And moreover, I think there is deterrent value to some of this activity, because even though in this case we didn't see an arrest, Matveev is believed to be located in Russia, and certainly the Russian government is not going to be turning him over. But this kind of indictment, it shows yet again that engaging in these kinds of ransomware attacks is not cost-free, and that the individuals behind these attacks can be identified by name. And it means that these actors can't simply hide in the shadows behind this activity. And even if they live in a jurisdiction where U.S. law enforcement can't get to them, they'll be looking over their shoulder, and they'll be limited in where they can travel for the rest of their lives. And so at the margins, these kinds of operations can do quite a bit to combat this activity and to make it harder for these actors to recruit and to conduct their attacks.
So I would note that the Treasury Department, I guess, in conjunction with this indictment, has sanctioned Matveev. What are we to make of that? And any complications that arise perhaps for victims because of that sanction activity?
Well, I'll say first that the Treasury Department has been very active in this space and has been using its sanctions authorities to go after infrastructure that these actors use, whether it's mixing services that they use to try to obfuscate their activity, or cryptocurrency exchanges where they try to convert their Bitcoin or other cryptocurrency ransom payments into fiat currency, and they have gone after some of the individuals behind these ransomware attacks as well. One of the challenges with these operations is, of course, that when one of these actors is sanctioned, it also creates compliance issues for victims. It means those victims now have to worry about a potential sanctions violation if they make a payment to a group that Matveyev or another sanctioned actor is affiliated with. And of course, while law enforcement, with the benefit of its resources and law enforcement tools and with the benefit of significant time to investigate these activities, can associate a particular attack to a particular individual, when victims are faced with the urgent response that is often involved in responding to these ransomware attacks, they may not have the benefit of all of that information to be able to very carefully attribute whether, you know, their attack and the person behind the keyboard who they're communicating with happens to be Matveyev or another sanctioned actor. And so it creates compliance challenges, and so that's another aspect of these disruption operations that's notable and that the government, I'm sure, is thinking through as well.
Is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners today?
You know, it's interesting to see the pace of the government's operations in this space. In just the last 2 weeks, we've now seen, you know, a further disruption operation related to the ransomware. Last week was as we talked about at length, the disruption of the snake malware. It's clear that the focus that the department has put on disrupting this kind of malicious cyber activity is paying off in the amount of disruptions they've been able to string together in recent weeks and months. And I expect we'll continue to see these kinds of operations in other contexts. So look forward to doing another podcast on new developments soon.
Absolutely. Look forward to having you back. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, Stephanie.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare material supporter at patreon.com/lawfare. You'll also get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. Please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Look out for our other podcasts, including Rational Security, Chatter, Allies, and The Aftermath, our latest Lawfare Presents podcast series on the government's response to January 6th. Check out our written work at lawfareblog.com. The podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell, and your audio engineer this episode was Noam Osband of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.